You're listening to Wellness Wednesday, a show about health and wellness in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. This week, Peace Talk with Tundra Women's Coalition.
Welcome and thank you for joining us today on TWC's Peace Talk radio show. TWC's mission in the region is to provide safe, empowering services for families experiencing domestic or sexual violence. We seek to promote violence-free communities through culturally appropriate outreach programs and supportive services. The Peace Talk radio show is our opportunity to let the region know what work we are doing and answer questions if people have them. This is a call-in show, so if you have any questions, please feel free to call at 907-543-2756. So the thrift store will not be accepting donations at the moment due to an overcrowding of clothing, so though we always utilize and appreciate the generosity of our community, we will rely and will rely on it in the future. We are holding off on accepting donations. There are jobs opening at TWC, so if you're interested in becoming a part of the TWC family, you can find the application at www.tundrapeace.org. If you want any information about TWC and the programs and services we provide, you can call TWC and contact us. Our 24-hour crisis line is 907-543-3456. Our toll-free number is 1-800-478-7799. And the Bethel local business line is 907-543-3444. Again, if during the show you would like to call, in call 907-543-2756. So our topic today is due to the new year, and we're going to be talking about recovery. I'm Annie Mae Lee, and I'll be your host today. Would you guys like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. Good morning. This is Charlotte Gruber. I'm a therapist who works at YKHC.
And my name is Nikolai Joke, and I manage the shelter here at TWC.
So we're going to share a little bit about our personal histories, and I guess we'll start with mine. So hello, my name is Annie Mae Lee, and I've been working in at TWC with prevention and crisis relief for about 6 years. And I'm passionate about it because I kind of started as a very, very young person in prevention, coming through the children and teen programs. And I think it's really, really important to talk about recovery because my first experiences with witnessing addiction or being around addiction were started from when I was a very young child. And there was not much education for me. And I didn't really know kind of what was going on or kind of what it all meant. So I thought that today would be a wonderful day to kind of answer, one, some of the questions I have and really talk about my experiences.
This is Charlotte. I have a master's in social work, and the way I originally got interested in that was I actually worked at Tundra Women's Coalition also back in 2010 for a couple of years, and I was a shelter advocate, and I learned through that job that I really enjoyed working very, like, directly and closely with people, so I decided to go to school. I was interested in mental health, but I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do, and I'm happy that I kind of fell into the job of a therapist or counselor. I use those words interchangeably. So I've been doing that for several years now. I really enjoy it, and something that's important to me is destigmatizing mental health because the more that I've learned about it, both as a therapist and as a client when I do work with my own therapist, I think it's important that we really radically change the way we see mental health and acknowledge that it's just a part of everybody's life. It means that sometimes you don't feel happy, and that's okay. And if it's something that's persisting, there are things that you can do about it. So it's really important to me to kind of spread that information because I think there's a lot of misconceptions. Thank you.
Yeah, and this is Nikolai. What I bring to the table here at TWC is through my professional work, I'm an administrative professional. So I bring a lot of structure building to the places that I work. So I helped to create admin manuals and standard operating procedures and offer support to the advocates that work with our residents here at TWC. I'm also a recovering alcoholic. I'm coming up on 3 years sober. I actually came to rehab in the residential program at Ayaganavik Healing Center, which used to be PATC in their old location. And I'm also an advocate for social justice. I love politics and making sure that our voices are heard as Indigenous people. Thanks.
All right. So before we say anything, I just want to say that all statements or opinions shared on the Peace Talk Radio Show are coming from a place of education and collaboration. We do not come from a place of judgment or the idea that we know what is best for any person who may be listening, and our goal is simply to share with the community and hopefully learn together. And this kind of topic is a little heavy, just kind of inherently, because it's a big, again, like Charlotte said, very stigmatized within our community, and so I just wanted to let everybody know that ahead of time. So, Charlotte and Nikolai, what are some ideas or misconceptions that are stigmatized about people with addiction, and what effect do you see kind of these misconceptions having?
So, Charlotte, if you don't mind, let me go first, and you could back it up with science. How's that?
That's perfect.
All right. So one of the things that I learned about when I was early in recovery was the fact that alcoholism, being an alcoholic, has nothing to do with how much anyone drinks, how much anyone has lost. So one of the biggest misconceptions that kept me in my addiction for so long was the fact that I used to think, I can't be an alcoholic. I have a job, I have, you know, a house, I have, I'm married and I have two kids, and there's no way that I could be an alcoholic. And I would tell myself this and just be drinking uncontrollably and thinking in my head that next time it's going to be different. I'm going to try something different next time and it's going to work. Like, there's no way that I could be an alcoholic. So that's one of the biggest misconceptions about alcoholism and being an alcoholic, is that it's not about what, it's not about how much you drink. It's about what the drink does to you. So one of the things that I learned in the AA program that alcoholism is a disease, and it's the way that it works in the body is that alcohol triggers an allergic reaction in alcoholics. So much like when you have a food allergy, you eat something, you break out in hives, that's your body's natural response to that allergen. And so what happens in an alcoholic's body is you take a drink of the alcohol and it triggers a reaction within your body to crave more and more and more. So that's what I wanted to bring to the table. And Charlotte?
Yeah, thanks, Nikolai. I'll give a little brain info, but I do want to second something important that Nikolai said. Annie May and he and I discussed this, that I think there's sort of a very human nature thing that we do where if something looks okay, we think it's okay. And I appreciate Nikolai's point about alcoholism is not so much about how many drinks you're having. It's more about the way, like, we're relating to the alcohol, or like the relationship that we have with drinking. And so just because, and this kind of ties in with generally with mental health concerns, just because someone appears to be okay doesn't necessarily mean that they are. I think we all have gone through that experience of knowing what it's like to really be covering up the pain and the suffering that we're going through. And that suffering that we feel is something that feels kind of embarrassing sometimes to share. And the reality is everybody has mental health concerns. All it means is that mental health just means anything related to feeling. So feeling angry or stressed or sad are all mental health concerns. And what you can do is what's important if you address them, it's something that we can do to help keep ourselves healthy. So thinking specifically about addiction, addiction and other really common mental health concerns like depression and anxiety, for example, something that I think is a really important point to make is that addiction and mental health concerns are not about your character. They're not about who you are as a person. I think something that we believe is there must be something wrong with me, or I'm weak, or why is it that I have this struggle? Addiction is about patterns of behavior that you have taught your brain to do, and I'll explain that a little bit more. The brain likes patterns. The brain pays attention to what we tell it. Our brain's most important job is keeping us safe and keeping us alive. It's wired for survival. And so our brain is kind of constantly watching our behavior to learn from us. And when we teach it something, it wants to do that pattern again to help us out. So, for example, kind of a common experience we might have is we use alcohol to cope with stress or depression or anxiety or grief. And so let's say when I feel stressed out, I drink. My brain notices that I use alcohol to try to cope with my stress. So in order to help me, the next time I get stressed, my brain is sort of going to offer that thought up to me. And it's going to say, hey, Charlotte, I saw you use alcohol last time. So is this something that I can help you with right now so that you feel better? And so this is sort of how addiction is formed. It's not about you kind of having something wrong with you. It's just about this, like, very deeply ingrained pattern that becomes very, very automatic in your brain. So what's exciting is to work on overcoming addiction, to work on stopping a substance if that's something you want to do. The more you learn about the way the brain works, the more you can kind of partner up with it to work on overcoming your cravings and not using anymore. And I'll explain a little bit more about that in detail later. Thanks.
Yeah, and I like, Charlotte, you know, what you touched on with regarding character, and I could relate to that so much, but I wanted to bring up a quote from a famous person right now. Her name is Brené Brown, and she's an author, and she does a lot of community speaking, and the way that I heard about her was she talked with Oprah. I love Oprah, and so one of the things that she does is she's a researcher, and she researches shame. And her, what she found from the research that she did on shame was, you know, she takes all of the data that she has collected throughout her research, and she comes up with definitions. And the definition that she came up with for shame was the intensely painful feeling that we are unworthy of love and belonging. And I'll say that again. Her definition of shame: the intensely painful feeling that we are unworthy of love and belonging. And she said that shame thrives with secrecy, silence, and judgment, and is healed with empathy. So you could find Brené Brown's talks on YouTube. She's been on TED Talks. That's how she became famous. And she's also written books. And I've also found one of her speeches, one of her public speeches in Netflix. Thanks.
Wow, I didn't know she was on there. I actually think that one of the things that we talked about when we were having this kind of conversation is kind of like, we were talking about how like these things are stigmatized and how kind of there's not a lot of information. And I kind of before, and it's a question that I've since deleted since I think we might go over time, but I kind of talked about the way that people kind of go back to using again, or they've used alcohol or drugs again. And I didn't use kind of the right terminology. I used but they like failed or kind of went into a little bit of a discussion about the differences and kind of the power with that, because you know, we talk about what effect do we see kind of these misconceptions happening.
Charlotte, if you don't mind me speaking to this again, and then you could back it up with the science. I think what Annie is referring to is we talked about the difference between relapse and using again, and that's one of the most powerful tools that I learned in my recovery process was the difference, you know, the misconception that we have a lot about relapse. And so one of the biggest things that I learned was about how to be compassionate with myself, because I was so critical with myself, you know, when I was in active in my addiction in drinking. And so there was a lot of self-loathing, a lot of repression, a lot of depression, a lot of anxiety. And one of the things that I learned about the term relapse is that relapse has nothing to do with using again. So I could relapse, I could allow myself and be forgiving to myself about relapsing, about giving up my program, you know, feeling like, I just don't want to continue to stay sober, you know, that's relapse. And that's different from actually having a drink again or having whatever it is that you're addicted to again. And so I wanted to make that clear about relapsing versus using again.
Thanks, Nikolai. I think that's very valuable information. And again, like anything we talk about today, we all have our own personal experiences of it where we know what it's like to beat ourselves up. We know what it's like to put ourselves down. And I think we've all noticed that that doesn't really get us anywhere. Something that we can – Nikolai's the distinction that he made between relapse is not necessarily using. It's more like your attitude or the way you're seeing something. The way that we understand an experience in our lives or the way we relate to it is hugely important regarding how we approach it. So, like, for example, if let's say I want to stop drinking and I drink – and I beat myself up, I berate myself, I say, you're never going to do this, well, then that's what's going to be true. Because once again, your brain is always trying to help you. And so if I say, you're never going to do this, my brain says, okay, then yeah, we're just going to stay, we're going to stay down here in the lower brain, the part of the brain that's responsible for stress and anger and fear. It's a very automatic, reactive part of the brain. Up around where your forehead is, you have your prefrontal cortex. And that's the part of your brain that's designed for logic. It's designed for thinking. It's where you're able to think through consequences. And so let's say if I drink and I wanted to stop using, rather than beat myself up, I can say, all right, this is a perfect chance for me to practice doing this again. And this ties in, I think, with Nikolai's very important part of self-compassion, forgiveness, and being understanding that change is a really long and it's a long process that requires a lot of work. And so be gentle with yourself. And again, the more that you take that attitude rather than beating yourself up, you're going to activate a part of your brain that is kind of, it's your upper brain. It's your brain, the part of the brain that thinks. The more you put yourself down, you're going to activate your limbic cortex, your lower brain, the part of the brain that's responsible for your like internal alarm system.
Thank you. This is kind of one that I'm actually going to turn around a little bit. Have you seen a lot of difficulties when there's a lack of understanding and support? How did people react with your decision to end your addiction? And what effect did that support or lack of support have?
Yeah, so I think the thing with my family, you know, watching me go down this path of addiction and just depression and all of those bad things, they were very relieved when I said that I was going into treatment. And I think that, you know, I'm always so happy that there are a lot of resources, a lot of conversation about addiction, you know, recovery from addiction. But what we don't see enough of, I think, is the fact that there's not enough support for people who are living with people who have addiction, who misuse alcohol, who use other drugs. And so a lot of times, you know, families and individuals who live with these people become codependent, and they just, It's a very unhealthy lifestyle, and so it's something that I wish we had more of out here. Is, you know, like Al-Anon and codependency classes and awareness and talking about how to get through all those things.
So what would those things kind of maybe have effect when it came to this codependency? Like, what would be the effect of those programs?
Can you ask that question again? Sorry.
Sorry. If we had those type of programs or we had those type of things here, kind of what do you see happening and what could be the effect of something like that?
I think the effect that, so the thing with codependency is it's an issue of control. So a lot of family members, you know, like parents, spouses, children of addicted individuals have a tendency to have to try to control things. And they think that, you know, if I take away every opportunity for access to alcohol, access to drugs, then things are going to be okay. When the problem is so much deeper than that, it's not about access and it's not about control. It's a deeper, there has to be an understanding that there's a deeper problem with this type of behavior. And I know that Charlotte will touch on those behavioral aspects of it. But codependency, the awareness of it and the working through codependency will help the families to heal themselves. Whether or not the person who is going through addiction chooses to go and start to their healing process.
All right. Thank you.
Were you going to say anything, Annie Mae?
No, I just was saying, do you have a little information on this?
Sure, yeah. So, you know, as Nikolai had mentioned, I think we certainly could provide better access here to resources. There are some available. We could always use more. It's something that we know a lot of us would benefit from. Thinking about some barriers. So, like, for example, kind of just a general lack of services. Something I'll speak kind of specifically to my job here at the hospital and what I see here. So I work at YKHC. I work in the primary care clinic, sometimes also called outpatient clinics. It's in the beautiful new building. It's all the hallways there on the first floor. And my role is, so people come here for appointments to see medical providers. And whenever there's a mental health concern, so it could be, depression, anxiety, domestic violence, stress, grief, suicidal thoughts, anything like that. The provider might ask me to come talk with the person that day. So the idea is we're hoping to kind of catch people right when they're there in a moment of need rather than saying, okay, we'll have someone follow up with you later. And a term that I think of that I'm sure Annie Mae and Nikolai know working at Tender Women's Coalition and some of the folks who are listening maybe have heard this. The phrase is trauma-informed. And what that means is, kind of like what we had mentioned earlier about, like, you know, appearances are not always what they seem. To see somebody, so for example, here in the clinics, the reason for referral a lot of the time, like why a provider would contact me, is addiction or substance misuse. And if you don't take a trauma-informed approach, what that can kind of seem like is, man, this person is, like, really drinking too much or smoking way too much, and why aren't they just making the change and doing something different? That's not a trauma-informed approach. Trauma-informed means that what's one of the main reasons that any of us use a substance or use too much of it? We're trying to cope with the emotional pain that we feel. We're trying to cope with disturbing thoughts, disturbing feelings, disturbing memories, disturbing body sensations. And so this is the reason why if I'm drunk or I'm high, I can cover all that stuff up. So something that I think can be, when we think about a lack of understanding, is that can create another barrier for folks, especially like if they're trying to access services at the hospital, which is, you know, something, you're not doing something right, just do something different. Having a trauma-informed approach is something that kind of breaks down that barrier to have a much more understanding and like fuller idea or picture of what people are going through. And I think if we try to focus more on that, that's going to be very helpful for folks.
Thank you. And actually, I've heard you say something before that really really kind of stuck with me, and that was that you've never really seen anyone who came in as an alcoholic because they, you know, they just liked alcohol and they were trying to have fun. It was always that there was, like, many layers of, like, pain underneath it. And it's not like this is the first time I've ever heard of it, but I've heard that, but, like, it was the first time I've heard it said so, like, kind of bluntly, I feel. Like, just, like, it's not because of this. It's definitely not just because people are having fun and they like the substance. I just kind of wanted to bring that up because it's always something that, like, sticks with me, especially when I'm working with people who have addiction, because we do have that a lot in the shelter.
I think that's a good point, Annie Mae. Certainly there are instances, you know, where people might say it's fun or, like, I like the way it makes me feel or I do it with my friends or whatever, and that can be a part of it. But yes, what you had mentioned that I had mentioned, I would say most times, when I talk with somebody who is using a substance in a way where it's really interfering with a healthy life, if we kind of dig a little bit more and we peel back some of the layers and they're willing to kind of engage in some of the questions that I'm posing to them, absolutely, we usually get to a place of, I'm using because I am just trying so hard to not feel this pain that I'm carrying. So, yeah, thanks for mentioning that.
All right. So were there any difficulties with recovery that you feel you weren't ready for, or what things come as a surprise to clients when working with people who are experiencing addiction?
So if I could go first again, Charlotte, you brought up a point a little while ago about when we peel back one of the layers, which is the use of alcohol, and then all of a sudden I'm feeling things, like I'm feeling anxiety, I'm feeling all of the effects that of things that I haven't worked through in life that are bubbling up to the surface. And one of the most important tools that I learned when I was in treatment was about looking at how I'm feeling with curiosity and not with judgment. That was a huge breakthrough when I could feel these symptoms of, like, anxiety coming up. I feel like my breath is getting short. I feel like, you know, there's tingling in my body, and oh my God, I'm going to have an anxiety attack. Those kinds of, I can't count the number of those kind of moments that I had. And then to try to remember to stop myself and say, hey, it's okay. Like, I'm feeling this way and it's okay right now. It's what my body needs. It's what I need at this moment. And I don't need to drink and try to push these feelings down. So that was a breakthrough moment for me. I just appreciate that Charlotte brought that up.
Nikolai, it's, yes, like the way you just described it kind of gives us a clear picture of, like, it's a very unpleasant experience when all that stuff comes up, isn't it?
Yeah, it's horrible.
Yes, it's such a challenge, and I think a couple important things to say about it is so normal, and Nikolai made an important point about having a mindful approach to all of those thoughts and feelings that are coming up. The short answer here is the more you fight anything unpleasant that's happening inside your skin, thoughts, feelings, body sensations, the more you fight them, the worse they get. So I would say for anyone who is trying to stay sober, just be prepared for your symptoms to increase. I mean, potentially even very high. And I know that sucks, but it's actually really a good sign. Because what's happening is that stuff is finally coming up. And this is when we have a really exciting choice to either try to push it back down, use something else to get rid of it, or to face it and do something about it, which can kind of kick our butts, but the good thing about that is if you face it finally, it's going to go away. It's going to go away finally. And if you don't, it's just going to kind of stick around because it wants your attention. So I would say expect an increase in symptoms, incredibly normal, and think to yourself that when that happens, that's the sweet spot of change. That's exactly the part where you can say, I'm going to try to teach my brain something different. I'm going to try to form a new, healthier pattern. And one way that we can absolutely do that is taking that curious attitude that Nikolai talked about. What we learn with our depression, our anxiety, our cravings, is the more we tolerate them, the less disturbing they are going to become.
All right. Thank you. And we kind of talked a little bit about how kind of you would feel. And I really wanted to touch on kind of like what this feeling of like overwhelm or these kind of feelings of these symptoms increasing actually might be. I know for me, when I was cutting down, my biggest one was that I couldn't focus on anything but the kitchen, which is where I would keep like my beer or any of my like alcohol that I had. And that's kind of where my feeling of overwhelm started. And then it kind of, again, like he said, it increased my anxiety, kind of a lot. But then I would get like very, very restless in between. And I know that it's like different for everyone, but I just kind of want to point out like, that's my experience with it.
What are you bring up a good point, Annie Mae. And, I laugh because it's just like hearing myself. And, and if Charlotte, if you want to touch on this in a little while, but the phenomenon of, one of the aspects of being in active addiction is the insanity of, you know, the compulsions, and then also just being overwhelmed with the thoughts of alcohol. And the word escapes me right now. Charlotte, hopefully you could bring it up. Just having all the thoughts over, the obsession, that's what it is, the obsession of alcohol and the addiction.
Yes, it is absolutely. It is an obsession, and sort of to our points we made a couple minutes ago, that is an incredibly unpleasant, disturbing, it can be a very scary experience. The way that you approach it can, you know, make a huge difference in what the outcome is going to be. So again, the more you fight it, the more you say you hate it or you can't stand it, that's what's going to be true. The more that you practice having a accepting, like I'm talking like a radically accepting attitude, which this is not easy. It's something that it's like any other skill. The more you practice it, the easier it gets. You have a very accepting attitude. You have a very self-compassionate attitude, a very patient attitude. And these are the kinds of, you just practice it over and over again. And when you're feeling overwhelmed, stay with it. Think of like, it's like you're riding a wave and it's going to pass.
Yeah. You brought up a good point earlier too, about, you know, you reframed, you know, the experience of feeling those feelings in such a positive way that it reminded me of another Brené Brown thing. I love her because, one of the things that she brought up, was the word courage. And so, she did research around courage and how to measure it. And the way that she found that the only way that you can measure courage is by how vulnerable you choose to be. So you can't have courage if you don't have the vulnerability, if you don't allow yourself to be vulnerable to and open to having those experiences.
I think that's brilliant. I love that quote. That's amazing.
I also wanted to say one thing. I used kind of the kitchen as an example. And I don't know if this will help anybody, but I think that this is one thing that helped me, especially when I was cutting down a lot. I went from getting like a half a bottle a day to like not that many drinks a week at all. So I actually had to kind of rewire my brain and then just think like, oh, good job, brain. I am feeling a little anxious. Maybe I'll go make myself some tea instead. You know?
Yeah.
I kind of had to think like that. Well, it's the kitchen, so there's definitely things that I could do to help my anxiety, and I love tea. And that's kind of one of the things that I did. It was just really, really helpful in those moments. Just pat myself on the back and be like, good job, brain.
Yes, and I love that attitude. I think thanking our brain and saying, I appreciate what you're trying to do for me is a really helpful attitude to take. So, and I'll provide a little more information on this in a little bit. But, like, remember that your brain's always trying to help you, even if it's misguided. So, like, when you have a craving, it's trying to help you. When you're anxious, it's trying to help you because anxiety is sort of like your brain's alarm system. It's worried you might be in danger. And so I think saying, hey, brain, thank you so much for trying to protect me. Thanks for this anxiety right now. I think that's something that can really help take some of the fear out of it.
It very definitely helps for me.
Good.
So actually, this is leading directly into the next topic. So in those most difficult times of cravings and temptations, what kind of drives you to stay grounded in your decision to recover? Or and how did you keep your resolve? Or what are some common triggers for people who are recovering that they need help with? And we talked a little bit about this, but it doesn't help to talk a little more.
Nikolai, do you want to go first, or do you want me to?
Actually, I wanted to follow you.
Okay. Sounds great. So I'll start with talking about, so when we think about, yes, feeling tempted to want to use, feeling triggered to use, we all have values, we all have ideals, things that are important to us, the kind of person that we want to be. When I talk with clients who don't want to use anymore, who want to stay sober, this is really essentially what it comes down to, which is like, you know, I want to be a good parent, or I used to really do a lot of subsistence and I don't anymore, or I was going to school and now I'm not. And the thing is addiction goes against the values that we have of being, you know, like kind people, of being smart people, of being active in our community. Addiction kind of interferes with that. So I would encourage people, when we're thinking about, like, I don't want to use anymore, and you're triggered or you're feeling tempted, remind yourself of why you made this decision. Why say to yourself, why was it important to me to not do this anymore? Why did I feel like using goes against the values that I have? And it's something that is not going to, it's with any kind of suffering that we have emotionally, it's not going to shut off like a switch. You're going to have to kind of write it out. But it's something that will help you sort of anchor yourself and just sort of be patient while you're having that kind of internal storm of the craving or the obsession or the anxiety. You remind yourself, okay, my values and my ideals are exactly why I'm making the choice to just let this kind of hurt right now rather than choosing to use.
I love that you brought up the analogy of anchoring yourself, because one of the other key turning points in my recovery process when I was in inpatient treatment was I was working with Julie Thompson, who was a clinician at the time. She's an amazing person. She and I have remained friends. But the one exercise that we did in our grounding meditation sessions was she asked me to visualize myself as a little kid. And one of my favorite pictures of myself is when I was like 6 or 7 years old. You know, by then my front teeth were pulled out, you know, being a village kid. So it was during a spring flood, and I had climbed up, on a log to our old three-wheeler, trying to stay out of the water, and I have this big goofy grin. So that's the image that came to me. And she asked me to imagine myself in my safe place. And that's, for me, that's a beach in Hawaii. And so she asked me to say, what are you going to say to yourself? What do you want to say to this little boy, this sweet, innocent, young little boy? And so, you know, I grabbed this, you know, little version of myself, and I said, it's going to be okay. And that, doing that, dropped that anchor for me. It, up to that point, I just felt like I was floating around everywhere. I didn't know what was going on. I knew I wanted to be well, but that exercise itself dropped that anchor, and I was finally able to begin my healing process. And I get emotional about it even now, talking about it. But one of the things that we had to work at was, that I had to work at, was to sit and to identify what my values were. And one of the things that I did when I went into treatment, about 3 or 4 days in, when my head started to clear up, I wrote this letter to myself talking about how my life had been up until that point, how I was feeling at that point, and the kind of life that I wanted to have in the future. And that I wanted to be integrated. I wanted my values to be in line with my actions and my decisions. I wanted to be someone that I've always wanted to that I've always looked up to, you know, to be integrated and to be confident and live my truth. And that was the beginning of it. I really enjoyed that process. At the time, it was uncomfortable, and I still have moments where I do feel uncomfortable, but the way that I look at the uncomfortable process now is different than when I did when I first started the recovery process. I don't look at it in a fearful way. I look at it as an opportunity to grow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's amazing. And yeah, you just use exactly the right words, Nikolai. You try not to be afraid of it. You try to see it as a way to grow. That's a perfect attitude to have. And thanks for sharing that exercise. That's such a great resource for people to know.
Yes, thank you very much. I really enjoyed that. So the next part we're going to talk about is a little bit of, like, common triggers. And, Charlotte, do you want to give us some brain science behind that?
Sure. So I'm going to share some kind of, again, very common experiences for any of us who are using and wanting to stop. So like we had discussed earlier, a lot of times the reason why we start using something too much is because we are trying to deal with whatever unpleasant thoughts and feelings we have. So just know that when you're not using, remember your brain is going to continue to kind of say, but this is what you showed me in the past. This is what you've done. Don't you want to use this? And this is where kind of earlier we mentioned we can say, like, thank you, brain. This is a great opportunity to say, brain, I know you're doing your job. I know you're trying to help me right now. I'm making a decision to do something different. So just be mindful that once you stop using, the anxiety might increase. Memories that you were trying to block out are going to come back, and it's unpleasant, but it's totally normal. So you can kind of prepare yourself. Know that, okay, whenever I got anxious, I drank. Well, now that you know that you're not drinking anymore, you can kind of prepare yourself for every time I get anxious, I'm probably going to feel triggered to want to use, and that's something that you can say, you know, those are exactly the chances that I need to practice this. Another common trigger is any sort of routine that was around using. So it could be people that you were with. It could be a certain place that you would go to. It could be a time of day, like if you drink when you get home from work or you drink on the weekends or whatever it is. And so, again, your brain, anything that reminds your brain of using is going to trigger you. Once again, not because your brain's trying to sabotage you, it's trying to help. It's saying, oh, when you're with these people, this is what you do. Oh, when you come home from work, this is what you do. So, again, something else to be mindful of. Know that that's going to happen, totally normal. And these are where we sometimes have some pretty tough choices to make about, like, are there certain people maybe that I'm not going to see anymore? Or is there a certain, like, group that I would go hang out with or, like, is there kind of a routine hangout I would do each week and I'm not going to do anymore? And that can be really challenging. But, again, this is where we draw on our values and say, yes, this is something I want to change. So, again, common triggers are mental health concerns that we were trying to cover up and then any kind of routine around the substance. So these are kind of good things that we can prepare ourselves for.
Thank you. And I actually want to speak a little bit more to my own experience, is that when I had alcohol, really anxiety was a big trigger for me. It actually started at my insomnia, my nightmares, and getting anxiety at night. And then I would find that, you know, alcohol would help me sleep and I would feel a little less stressed, but then I really found it increasing. And really when I had to cut down, the biggest thing was changing my environment, because when I was drinking more, my house was chaos. It was not necessarily dirty all the time, but it was messy all the time, very, very messy. And one of the things that helped me actually cut down is just keeping a clean house. That little change of environment actually really helped. So I just wanted to share that in case, you know, anybody wants to know a way that they could kind of change their environment. If you're used to drinking at home, one of the biggest things was just we kept a clean house and it was easier to cut down.
Annie Mae, thanks for sharing that, because I think something that happens a lot too when we think about mental health is we think that in order to make change, it has to be this huge, like, drastic, very obvious thing, and it's really not. It's about little things just like that, where it's like, okay, how does cleaning my house make that big of a deal? But just like what you shared, you noticed how impactful it was, and so I think that's a great thing for people to pay attention to, is sometimes it could be something that seems kind of small, but it's connected to using in a strong way.
Yeah, and if I could piggyback off of what you guys are saying as well, I love that you said that it's not this monumental, like, humongous deal. It's all of the little things that are stacked up on top of each other. And I wanted to touch on negative self-talk versus positive self-talk because, you know, it all has to do with having compassion. And one of my favorite quotes that I came across was, love yourself like you would, or talk to yourself like you would someone you love. And so that's one of the biggest little changes that I had to make within my inner life. Not telling myself, oh, you're so stupid. Why are you, you know, you're worthless. Why are you drinking all the time? You're better than this. And so all of those things, and I wanted to bring up, being on the subject of talking, I wanted to bring up a quote by Maya Angelou, famous poet. She said, words are things, I am convinced. They get into your wallpaper. They get into your rugs, your upholstery, in your clothes, and finally, into you. We must be careful about the words we use. Someday, we will be able to measure the power of words. And I think it's pretty self-evident, to piggyback on what you said, Charlotte, that our thoughts, our intentions, the words, the way that we talk to ourselves, really do manifest in the life that we live. And so that's something that I have to be mindful about. What kind of perceptions do I have of myself? How do I talk to myself, you know, within my body? Like, when I make a mistake, am I telling myself, oh, you're so stupid?
Right.
No, I mean, it's all of those little things saying, I tried, you know, I'm courageous. I'm being vulnerable right now and I'm okay. Things are going to be okay.
Right. Yeah, thanks, Nikolai. Also,
yeah,
great quote again. Yeah, language is so powerful.
All right. So can you tell me about any lessons that you learned from your journey or any information you wish you had known right at the beginning that might make it easier? I'll start this one, actually. One is just that, you know, I was diagnosed with PTSD, and with that, I noticed that, it's an anxiety disorder. And what I really didn't try to do at all was, really deal with kind of the issues underlying. And I know this is, really obvious to, most people who've worked with recovery or been in recovery. But to me, it started off actually not that obvious. You know, I had maybe a glass of wine to relieve my anxiety, and then as my anxiety grew, so did my usage, and the more I used, my anxiety grew even more. And one thing I want to say is that, yes, you got to deal with kind of the issues underlying, but sometimes just focusing a little bit, when you're really thinking about those anxious times and when you're really thinking about what's causing it, really just allowing yourself to feel it. And I know that we already touched on this, but my biggest issue when it came to me having PTSD is, the avoidance that came with it. And Charlotte, sorry, I'm kind of leading into what you're going into, so I just want to say that it was actually really hard to recognize the anxiety for what it was. And I had anxiety around getting help, and I had anxiety around telling people. And one of the biggest steps was me accepting that I had it and letting people know I had it. I was very used to kind of dealing with things on my own, not really telling anyone, not really allowing myself to be, really vulnerable around people. And then when I finally did and I decided, you know what, I can't really take this on by myself, I was doing things just randomly passing out from anxiety that I really had to get to an extreme place in my anxiety before I even, like, really connected the two that much. And I just wanted to say it's not always that obvious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you, Annie Mae. And I think that ties in with some of the stuff that we discussed earlier where Nikolai shared that quote about how, like, being quiet kind of feeds that shame that we feel. And this is something I shared earlier, is I think we so need to radically change how we understand mental health. And thank you very much for being, both of you, for this. It's vulnerable to share these experiences. And the reality is, like, so many people are going through the same thing. It doesn't feel that way, but that's the case. And, like, we all have ways we feel bad about ourselves. We all have thoughts that are kind of weird. Like, we all have these experiences that we think are so strange, and it's really just kind of normal human stuff. So what I'll share to this last point, I'm going to kind of review some important points that we've talked about and kind of give some very concrete steps that people can use. Working on being sober or a lot of other mental health concerns that we might have. So before I do that, Annie Mae or Nikolai, do you guys want to add anything else?
Well, I was just going to talk about, since this is something about any lessons that I've learned from my journey, some of the biggest things that I had to work on was my anxiety and my depression. Once, I'd been dry for a couple days, and I still had to deal with my anxiety and my depression. And so the first time that I had a conversation with a medical provider, I think it was Dr. Gray, I believe, or Dr. White, I'm sorry. And so I talked about, my depression and how I was feeling and how the depression was, kicking off like anxiety and symptoms and things like that. I had to start taking medication. I had to be okay and open to taking medication because I think there's some stigma around that as well. Like, oh, I don't need medication. Like, it's not that bad. And so I had to be honest and truthful with exactly where I was at and what, the threshold of what I can deal with by myself versus asking for help and actually accepting help. And so I got on medication for my depression, and I was on it for a good, 2 years, and it helped to get me out of that ditch that I couldn't crawl myself out of. But I wanted to touch on, some of the things that led me to, the behaviors that led to addiction, full-blown addiction to alcohol, and that's repression. When I was growing up in my small community of Nebuskak, there's only like 400 people. And I realized that I'm bisexual and, I attracted sexually to both males and females. And I hated that part of myself because I realized that that was something in my society that was not good. Oh, you're going to go to hell for it. It's a sin. And all of these different things that made me hate myself. And so that brought on so many behaviors and so much negative. I had such a bad negative self-image, and my self-esteem was so low that it just. I spoke about it a little while ago. I just felt like I was floating around wherever my feelings took me, wherever people's opinions took me, and so when I had to get real about who I was and how I was living. The only person that I really came out to in my family was my sister. And when I told her, she's like, oh, I know, and I still love you. It wasn't a big deal to her. It was a huge deal to me. Like, it was such an enormous, like a giant elephant on my chest that, and to family that loves me, like, it's no big deal. And, I didn't come out to my parents, but, I brought home my boyfriend. We bought a house together. I started taking him home to my parents, to family functions and things like that. And they're fine with that. But I had to, above everything else, like, I had to be okay with who I am, that self-acceptance had to come first, and I had to be okay with myself whether or not anyone else was okay with me. So I had to have that conversation and that understanding within myself and that loving and compassion to myself first before I had it for anyone else. And so I kind of wanted to touch on as well the reason why I bring up, you know, the fact that I'm Native, the fact that I'm queer, because those statistics are so horrible for addiction and for alcohol misuse, for drug addiction, drug abuse. And so I always want to bring those aspects up of who I am, because I wanted to contribute to the positive side, that even though these statistics are really bad, there's those of us who work through them, and there is hope. Thanks.
Right. Yeah, thank you, Nikolai. And to that I would say, we all know, because we all have this in our own lives, that, like, life is going to really knock us down sometimes. People are going to try to do the same thing, and so we have a choice. Like, that's a fact. Like, it's going to happen. So then we have a choice of how we respond to it. I think maybe last thing I was going to share is I want to be mindful of the time. I'll quickly go over some brain information. So here is like a short little like nugget, I would say, for people to keep in their mind. Avoidance is the enemy. The more you avoid a thought, a feeling, a body sensation, a situation, whatever it is, the scarier it's going to become. And I want to talk about two important things that happen in your brain. One is called threat learning, and I'll explain what that process is. And there's another process called safety learning. So threat learning means you could be scared of, just like I said, thought, feeling, body sensation. You could be scared of plane rides. You could be scared of talking in front of people. You could be scared of driving. You know, name it. It could be anything. The more you avoid it, the more you teach your brain it's something to get anxious about. That's called threat learning. So the process of safety learning is a very challenging, very exciting process of undoing what you've taught your brain and teaching it something new. And Annie Mae mentioned the term earlier, rewire. That is literally what you're doing. Is when you think a certain way about something or you act a certain way, you light up neurons in your brain. Neurons are like the little, like, twiggy. They kind of look like a little, like, I don't know what you would call it. Like, it's like little, it looks like a little, like, tree or something. They're connected to each other. And the more you think or act a certain way, you light up the neurons. The more you light them up, the kind of stronger that pattern becomes. So maybe some people have heard the phrase, the neurons that fire together, wire together. So safety learning is the process of lighting up new neurons. And here are, I'm going to give people two really concrete steps to practice anytime you notice a craving, anytime you notice anxiety, or anything that you want to avoid. Here are two things you can do. The first step is called reframing, which we've discussed. And it's a really awesome, powerful process. Nikolai said it perfectly earlier. How is this an opportunity to grow? So reframing does not mean you're pretending to be happy.
2021. It's, now is the perfect time to try something new.
Okay, well, thank you for listening to this.
Sorry, guys.
I hope you have a wonderful day.